So welcome on behalf of the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Media Practice Group, of which I am the chair. Welcome to our event today. It's called The Future of Media is Government Regulation in Today's Media Landscape Over the Top. I'm Brian Tremont. I'm the managing partner at Wilkinson Barker Knauer. And as I mentioned, I'm the head of the practice group. Before we get started, I wanted to thank the law school for hosting us today. This is our first event here at the law school, and we're very grateful for all the work that Tony Glosson and the rest of the team did to make today's event possible. We had tried to pull something together last year, and through a series of circumstances, weren't able to make that happen, and Tony and the team here really did a terrific job to pull this all together. I also want to thank Dean and David for all their great work and support from the Federalist Society in making the event such a success and such an easy thing to plan for all of us. As you know, we have sort of two parts of today's program. We have a keynote address from Commissioner Wright, and then we have our panel. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Tony, who is going to introduce the commissioner. And once again, thank you all very much for coming. And please feel free to join the Federalist Society as well as the practice group available to do that online. So please do so. And with that, I'll turn it over to Tony.
So as Brian mentioned, my name is Tony Glosson. I'm a student member of the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group and the Editor-in-Chief of the Federal Communications Law Journal here at GW. It's my great pleasure today to introduce a great friend of the Federalist Society and a valiant advocate for economic and regulatory sanity, Commissioner Josh Wright. You know, it's been noted that one could call Mr. Wright Commissioner, Doctor, Professor, or Counselor, and not be wrong. He received his PhD and his JD from UCLA, and he previously taught at George Mason Law before his appointment to the commission. He was the first scholar in residence at the FTC's Bureau of Competition, and he co-founded was a director of the International Center for Law and Economics, a dynamic and insightful policy organization here in D.C. All this to say, we're very fortunate to have the commissioner here to discuss the future of media with us today. So, thank you, Commissioner.
There are many more things you could call me and not be wrong. hear them from time to time. It is a pleasure to be here, and thanks for joining. It's always a pleasure to be here and participating in Federalist Society events. I want to start by thanking Tony and the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Media Practice Group and GW's chapter in particular for the invitation to speak with you today. Anytime I am at a podium or see anybody, more than three people anyway, in front of me, I say something like, the things I say, you don't get to blame on other commissioners or you know, even me some of the time. So don't do that. Today's conference occurs at a fortuitous time, as the FCC chairman has indicated the commission will be voting on new net neutrality regulations tomorrow. The connection between net neutrality and media regulation is obvious enough that I don't think it needs to be stated, but let's do it anyway. An increasing number of consumers use broadband internet access to consume an increasingly large amount of media. That media includes not only that which used to be consumed on the printed page, but also that which used to be consumed on the television, that which used to be consumed in a movie theater, and that which used to not be consumed too much at all, like, for instance, cat videos. Once we're able to review the FCC's specific proposed regulations tomorrow, I suspect the debate about the FCC's new approach will fairly quickly dive into the details of what I hear, or at least what I see from Commissioner Pai's tweeting, is a 332-page plan to regulate the Internet. The debate will no doubt be very interesting, and I expect will ultimately be resolved by the courts after a couple years of lawsuits. But today we have available to us what I think is an advantage in getting to talk about this before the report is released, in that it is the day before we have specific regulations to examine. At least for me, we have the luxury of what I think, and maybe the last day that we have the luxury, of thinking about this issue in an approach that focuses upon first principles rather than diving into the weeds. Today, I plan on talking about the economics of regulation more generally, with the hope of placing the broadband industry in that broader context. Rather than focus intensely upon how we regulate broadband, which we'll have ample time to do. I want to focus upon why and whether we need to regulate broadband in the first instance, and maybe even ask the question about whether we need to do so at all. My thesis is that the two major reasons that an economist might give you for regulating an industry, the presence of monopoly power of some sort or significant externalities, aren't present in the broadband industry, best I can tell. For that reason, we don't need to develop a new regulatory regime for broadband. Rather, we can use existing law and regulation to handle problems as they arise. In particular, I've argued elsewhere, and I continue to think that antitrust is particularly well-suited to protect consumer welfare from any losses, any issues that arise from priority contracting in broadband, the prohibition of which is the major target of Chairman Wheeler's soon-to-be-proposed regulations. Further, and at least until tomorrow, existing consumer protection law authorizes the FTC to prosecute deceptive and unfair acts or practices in broadband markets that harm consumers. Again, at least until tomorrow. The FCC has a long and sordid history in attempting to enact net neutrality regulations. I don't think it's a particularly good use of our time to recount that entire struggle here. However, I will note that my esteemed sister agency has taken several bites at the net neutrality apple, only to have it swatted away just as many times by the D.C. Circuit. The last swat occurred just over a year ago. I, for one, have been waiting anxiously to see how the FCC would respond, especially after President Obama threw his hat in the ring in favor of Title II regulation late last year. Shortly after the President's pronouncement, we learned earlier this month from the chairman of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, that the FCC planned to use its authority under Title II of the Communications Act of 1934 to regulate broadband providers as common carriers. Before I turn to discussing net neutrality specifically, I want to back up a step and ask a threshold question that I think often gets left out of policy debates involving net neutrality. That is, what's the economic problem the net neutrality is supposed to solve? In other words, what's the economic basis for any regulation in the broadband market? To answer this question properly, it's worthwhile first to consider the theoretical basis for economic regulation generally. In other words, what can we say generally about why regulation may be necessary in certain industries, and we'll explore whether those explanations appear to apply in broadband. The standard economic answer, and at least the one that will get you a passing grade in most regulatory economics 101 courses, is that a market failure is necessary but not sufficient for regulation. Market failure, that is, an identifiable reason why an unfettered market may result in a misallocation of resources, is necessary but not sufficient because there are multiple ways to solve problems involving market failure, some involving regulation and some not. If market failure exists, an important second question arises concerning the relative efficiency of different sorts of solutions. However, well-understood principles of the economics of regulation require a solid understanding of the market failure to be solved before moving on to evaluating the cost and benefits of any regulatory alternative. In short, it makes little subject consumers, in this case internet users, to a medical treatment or procedure without knowing whether they're sick in the first place and what the ailment is. There are four general descriptions of markets in which regulation might be necessary to correct a market failure. You think of this as a five-minute regulatory economics primer. The first is natural monopoly. Large fixed costs relative to the marginal cost of production. If that occurs, it might be efficient for one firm to produce. The trade-off we have here from a public policy perspective is pretty clear. The market efficiently bears one firm, and so we have a conflict, at least a theoretical conflict, between the free market, where outputs produced by a single supplier, and allocative efficiency. Why? Because our seller gets monopoly power. A second, you could think of it as a second or a subset of the first, is a more general category of, the more general phenomenon of monopoly power, including monopoly power that doesn't arise from natural monopoly conditions. Firms can acquire monopoly power without natural monopoly power, that is large economies of scale in some circumstances. There are a couple of agencies, one that writes my paycheck, that exists precisely to address these circumstances when they arise. While the acquisition of monopoly power and corresponding monopoly profits is often temporary because new entrants enter the market over time, economic welfare falls when a firm or firms exercise market power, increase the market price, reduce output beyond what would obtain in a competitive market. Firms can collude to do so. Sometimes they can act unilaterally. Government action and imposition of regulatory barriers to entry are also an important source of market power. Think regulations excluding Uber from the taxi market or state laws preventing the interstate shipment of wine. Antitrust law, in fact, exists to prohibit the exercise and acquisition of market power to address precisely these concerns. A third type, which we won't talk much about, that would get you above a passing grade in your regulatory economics course, is the mention of externalities. An externality, as all of you will know, occurs when a party to a market transaction doesn't internalize all the costs and benefits associated with that transaction. In other words, when the activities of one party imposes uncompensated benefits on another or costs on another. If negative externalities are present, think pollution, free market results in too much production. Conversely, when we've got positive externalities, a free market results in too little production. We generally think of negative externalities such as pollution. In fact, that's in 100% of the economics textbooks I've seen. But it's important to remember that positive externalities exist as well. Good example is education. A teacher and a student, a seller and the buyer in the market for legal education, both benefit when a student buys education from the teacher. At least that's what I told my former boss at George Mason. However, and some of my students in the room, I hope will testify as much, maybe. However, society at large also benefits from a more educated populace, and those benefits are difficult to capture in the private market exchange between a teacher and student. Accordingly, you can make out a sort of rational economic basis for some government intervention to encourage more education transactions between teachers and students. Some might require taxes or subsidies to induce parties to internalize cost or benefits. Of course, not all externalities are ubiquitous in the modern economy. Most don't require any sort of regulation at all because actors find ways to cheaply internalize the cost they impose on others. A fourth and final category, to round out our regulatory economics primer, involves failures in the market for information. Think asymmetric information between buyers and sellers. Sellers know the quality of the product, but the buyer doesn't. The efficient level of information is never perfect because information is costly to supply. In markets for goods and services, failures associated with inadequate or asymmetric information are often dealt with without government intervention. For example, firm strategies to credibly signal information to consumers, to commit to the buyer that I am a high-quality seller, I have high-quality products as opposed to my cheap rival. I may be able to offer a warranty. I may be able to advertise. Think about the rise of review sites that collect information about the quality of goods, Angie's List, Yelp, so forth, or other investments in reputation. Consumer protection law, if I didn't say this earlier, enforced by the FTC and broadband at least until tomorrow, prohibits deceptive statements and omissions that induce transactions that would not have occurred in the absence of market failure. So that's our primer. We've got sort of four candidates for market failure to walk through. I want to now take those and apply them to broadband and think about net neutrality. The natural question is, where does the market for broadband internet access fit into the economic theory of regulation sort of broadly defined? What market failure, if any, is the FCC trying to solve with net neutrality regulations? Statements from the FCC chairman are of little help. In a recent article, Chairman Wheeler said that the net neutrality regulations are necessary, quote, to preserve the internet as an open platform for innovation and free expression. It's hard to glean from this statement exactly what that means, or what economic forces at work today in the broadband market are preventing the internet from being an open platform for innovation and free expression. Anecdotal experience and my morning experience on my Twitter account provide contrary evidence every day. The chairman also says, quote, the fundamental problem is with allowing networks to act as gatekeepers. Now we might be getting somewhere. The word gatekeeper could have some relevant economic meaning. It's important, however, to pin down exactly what we think the chairman means by the term. There are gatekeepers everywhere. McDonald's is the gatekeeper of Coca-Cola beverages sold inside McDonald's restaurants. Starbucks is the gatekeeper to the happiness of my morning before I get my coffee. The supermarket is the gatekeeper to your access to Cheerios, or in my case, the all-marshmallow version of the Lucky Charms, in the supermarket aisle. A gatekeeper becomes an economic problem not because we assign it the label gatekeeper, but because it becomes a potentially worthy of regulation only when the gatekeeper stands between consumers and the only source of a desirable good or service. consumers are able to get Coca-Cola or similar beverages, or I can get my coffee from crossing the street from Starbucks to some other inferior coffee shop, then McDonald's will be unable to manipulate consumers' access to Coca-Cola in a way that makes consumers worse off, because if it does, consumers will vote with their feet and buy Coca-Cola from other sources. In short, it's competition that ensures that firms supply consumers access to the goods and service they want on desirable terms. In other words, the term gatekeeper, or the gatekeeper issue identified by Chairman Wheeler, is a problem of worthy of regulation only insofar as the broadband industry is a natural monopoly or otherwise exhibits meaningful monopoly power. That is a term of art, and it is a term of art that means the power to artificially increase market prices or artificially decrease market output below that which would obtain in a competitive market. The simple fact that there are multiple suppliers of both wired and wireless broadband internet renders this justification of regulation totally unpersuasive. I won't go into the details of the various empirical studies of the number of competitors or the intensity with which they compete in these markets, but a closer look, I think, renders the case even more unpersuasive. Moreover, as I'll explain a bit later, we have a legal regime specifically designed to address these sorts of problems. It is antitrust law. My point at this time is simply that the gatekeeper justification for broad sweeping net neutrality regulations can't possibly justify those regulations, because no broadband provider on its own can be viewed as a gatekeeper to anything when there's viable competition from other broadband providers. Being charitable to Chairman Wheeler, it could be that the desire to, quote, preserve the internet as an open platform for innovation and free expression reflects, instead of a concern about monopoly power, some vague concern about externalities. Indeed, Chairman Wheeler has touted the latest net neutrality regulation that it will, quote, ban paid prioritization and the blocking and throttling of lawful content and services. Perhaps the concern is that the broadband provider and the content provider don't internalize all of the costs associated with the contractual arrangement between them when the content provider pays the broadband provider for priority use of the network. This turns most of the economics of regulation, and certainly everything we know about the economics of externalities, on its head. Indeed, it is usually the use of prices that allows parties to internalize the cost and benefits of transactions. Nonetheless, the argument would seem to be that perhaps there's some social interest in egalitarian access to all broadband providers' networks. In effect, a one-size-fits-all contract between broadband providers and content providers. And that we cannot trust the marketplace to reach this outcome without regulatory intervention. An argument that the broadband market ought to be regulated because of externalities not captured in the bargains between broadband providers and content companies may be economically coherent, but it lacks any basis in fact. At this point, the problems associated with giving certain content providers preferential access to the network, and by extension, providing certain content providers with degraded access, are purely theoretical. As I'll explain shortly, there is both ample economic theory and empirical evidence to give substantial reason to believe that restrained distribution agreements, precisely the sorts of agreements targeted by the FCC's regulatory proposal, are actually more likely to result in benefits for consumers than in harm. I'd like now to transition from discussing net neutrality in the context of the economics of regulatory policy writ large to discussing net neutrality in the context of the economics of what economists will generally call vertical restraints. Paid prioritization sort of fits into this, but agreements generally between broadband providers and content providers are what I'm talking about in this context. Broadband providers and content providers occupy different positions in the supply chain, thus vertical in the restraint. The Netflix customer needs both content supplied through Netflix and broadband access supplied through any one of the number of broadband providers in order to enjoy Netflix video streaming product. An arrangement between Netflix and one broadband provider that ensures a certain level of speed for customers using the broadband provider network to access Netflix is simply what economists would call a vertical contractual arrangement between two entities operating at two links in the same supply chain. The world's full of vertical contracts across all sorts of industries, high-tech, low-tech, no-tech. Anywhere you can look, you can find vertical contracts. It should be no surprise. Industrial organization economists have been studying these types of contractual arrangements for decades. So we know quite a bit about their effects on the marketplace more generally. Although it's well accepted in the economics literature that vertical contracts can occasionally lead to anti-competitive foreclosure under certain specific conditions, and by the way, they violate the antitrust laws when they do, it is equally clear, and has been for a long time, that such arrangements are often part of the normal and healthy competitive process and can generate significant efficiencies that enhance consumer welfare. In fact, vertical contracts are frequently observed between firms lacking any meaningful market power, implying that there must be pro-consumer reasons for the practices. These efficiencies are at least partially passed on to consumers in the form of lower prices, increased output, higher quality, greater innovation, and the economics literature is again replete with empirical examples and studies documenting these points. In other words, the monopoly explanation that a monopolist uses vertical contracts primarily to foreclose rivals from access to a critical input or a critical set of customers can't be the reason for most of the instances of the contracts that we observe in the wild. Indeed, there's considerable empirical evidence that strongly supports the view that vertical contracts are generally pro-competitive. I've summarized this body of literature elsewhere, and for people who like talk of regressions and standard errors, there'll be cites in the speech when it's posted, but suffice it to say for the moment, and to spare you those sorts of details, let me quote from a study from agency economists, DOJ and FTC veterans, who studied all of the economics literature on vertical restraints, the exact type of contracts we're discussing regulating through Title II. They say, quote, with few exceptions, the literature does not support the view that these practices are used for anti-competitive reasons, which supports, quote, a fairly strong belief that these practices are unlikely to be anti-competitive in nearly all cases. That doesn't mean, of course, that these sorts of arrangements never do harm. And it does raise an interesting question about how to regulate a practice that's generally pro-competitive, but sometimes does harm. For students of antitrust law, if you're not thinking that's what antitrust law does, you should be. Although we don't have much of the sort of rigorous empirical evidence that I've discussed specifically relating to the broadband industry, there are some studies, and they're consistent with the general message from the literature. On top of that, anecdotal evidence all around us demonstrates that non-neutral business models deployed by broadband providers have been highly efficient. Chairman Wheeler's forthcoming proposal to place an outright ban on paid prioritization and the blocking and throttling of lawful content is what we can call a categorical prohibition on certain types of vertical contracts in the broadband industry. If there was strong evidence that those types of contracts did more harm than good to consumers, then a categorical ban could be justifiable. Well, as explained, the best available theory and evidence points in precisely the opposite direction. Vertical contracts are far more likely to benefit consumers than to harm them. However, it is undeniably true that vertical contracts can result in harm under some conditions. This raises, again, that same interesting question for the FCC. If an outright ban on vertical restraints in the broadband industry can't be justified, yet there's a chance that vertical restraints could harm some broadband consumers some of the time, then what should the FCC do? My answer is nothing. And the reason is because the FTC, my agency, is exceptionally well equipped to pick up the slack with existing antitrust laws and consumer protection laws, again, at least until tomorrow. The problem with the FCC's proposed approach to net neutrality is that there's no way to identify ex ante which vertical contracts are the harmful ones and which are the helpful ones. If economic theory and empirical evidence are correct, we have some sense roughly of the proportions of those groups. Contracts are generally helpful to consumers, and some minority subset of the contracts give rise to the risk of real competitive harm, but we can't identify them up front. In other words, the FCC is faced with a lack of any reliable or economically coherent method to identify network discrimination that harms consumers and should be barred as anti-competitive, or those that should be absolved as pro-competitive. But what's a novel policy dilemma for the FCC is a problem that antitrust law has been grappling with for over a century, and for which it offers a fairly clear solution. Indeed, the same sort of reasoning that promotes using tort or contract law to govern occasional disputes between private entities engaged in everyday life and business arrangements rather than regulate those activities prospectively supports the use of antitrust law to govern arrangements between broadband providers and content providers that end up reducing lawfare. Over the course of the last century, antitrust jurisprudence has evolved a highly sophisticated rule of reason to adjudicate various types of disputes involving various types of vertical arrangements by analyzing their cost and benefits to consumers. The rule of reason requires that each vertical arrangement be assessed on a case-by-case basis by marshaling the available economic literature and empirical evidence to evaluate the evidence of actual competitive harm under the specific circumstances of the case. Indeed, long ago, antitrust law initially adopted and ultimately rejected, largely based upon the development of economic empirical literature I discussed earlier, a categorical prohibition of vertical restraints, not unlike Chairman Wheeler's proposed prohibition on paid prioritization. The reason antitrust courts and agencies rejected the view underlying Chairman Wheeler's proposed ban is important. It's that a revolution injecting economic analysis and method into antitrust law swept through antitrust institutions in the 60s and 70s. Not a single antitrust observer that I've heard views that revolution as on net being unsuccessful or a bad investment for consumers. Now, the FCC need not catch up its understanding of industrial organization economics to the state of the art in 2015 to get this right. It only needs to embrace what was already well understood in antitrust by 1977, when the Supreme Court first accepted the basic economic principles that rejected categorical prohibitions of the sort embraced by net neutrality proponents. My view is that antitrust rule of reason is far more likely to maximize consumer welfare in the broadband industry than Chairman Wheeler's proposed ban. Any legal framework that seeks to maximize consumer welfare has to consider at least three things. First, the framework has to assess the probability that the challenged business arrangement is anti-competitive. Second, has to assess the probability that its application will result in errors, either false positives, in which arrangements that benefit consumers are wrongly condemned, or false negatives, in which arrangements that harm consumers are inadvertently allowed. Third, there are costs of running the system. You have to take into account the administrative costs of implementing a bright-line rule like a categorical ban on paid prioritization, or the often more involved and more expensive rule of reason. A rule that focuses upon minimizing the social costs of all of those types of errors, false positives, false negatives, and administrative costs, is most likely to generate the highest rate of return for consumers. Under Chairman Wheeler's proposed categorical prohibition, this analysis is pretty easy. There'll be no false negatives, only false positives, and it'll be pretty cheap to run. It's a categorical ban. Instances of pro-competitive conduct will be erroneously condemned, unless you think the empirical research and economic theory on the effects of vertical restraints is all wrong, at least applied to the broadband industry. It's true the rule of reason is probably more costly to administer in the individual case than a proposed blanket prohibition, but the administrative cost the FCC incurs in developing, defining, defending, and redefining, and maybe redefending whatever the net neutrality order says, or in court, is not trivial either. Although the affirmative case for antitrust over net neutrality is clear on consumer welfare grounds, net neutrality proponents often assert that antitrust might not, quote-unquote, work in all cases. That is, the rule of reason might allow some vertical contracts that harm consumers, whereas a blanket prohibition will get them all. That's true. And we'll also get all of the instances in which vertical contracts are pro-competitive. Now, I'm not sure what proponents mean by saying antitrust won't work. The idea of balancing both false positive and false negative seems like more of a feature of antitrust law than a bug. But this argument rejects a consumer welfare-based approach to regulation altogether by assuming, contrary to available theory, evidence, and experience, that every instance of conduct prohibited by the FCC's plan will be harmful to consumers. That argument simply can't be squared with the evidence. The same argument that antitrust doesn't work because it doesn't reach all of the possible harms suggested by net neutrality proponents asserts that there must be some dimension of cognizable harm outside of what's covered by antitrust and consumer protection law: price, output, quality, innovation. And that harm is both ubiquitous enough to justify categorical prohibition, but also only observable to the FCC. This should make any student of regulatory law and economics nervous, if not worse. I'm quite confident that if the antitrust regime, after more than a century of developing expertise and applying the rule of reason and identifying harmful vertical contracts while allowing pro-competitive ones to proceed, would be able to apply that rule in the broadband industry. To conclude, before we decide how best to regulate the broadband industry, today is a nice day to grapple with the antecedent question of whether and why we would do so in the first place. Too often the debate, in my view, over net neutrality is about the particulars of the FCC's latest proposed regulation, and I understand in 332 pages there's probably a lot to get excited about. I hope I've made the case that proponents of net neutrality regulation, and the FCC chairman in particular, haven't carried their burden, certainly from a regulatory economics perspective, of why such a proposal would be good for consumers. In fact, in my view, it is likely to harm them. Before I conclude today, I'd like to leave you with an example that came to me on my drive to work of more hospitable regulation in another industry. I have a lot to do on my morning drive, and so occasionally I think about regulation. And I thought about a case in which the case for regulation is generally far stronger than in the broadband industry. Locals in the room will no doubt be familiar with congestion pricing on Interstate 495, the Capital Beltway. Till just a few years ago, all drivers had equal, or we might say non-discriminatory, access in the parlance of the FCC's chairman on the Beltway in Virginia. Now, certain lanes on the Beltway are toll lanes, with the toll to be paid based upon the time of day and level of congestion. Although at this point, it's probably too early to tell whether the toll lanes on the Beltway have improved traffic conditions in Virginia. My own experience suggests that it has, though your mileage may literally vary. In any event, it's noteworthy that the Virginia DOT, the Department of Transportation, is exploring whether to expand the toll program to other highways in the state. The case for regulation in what I'll call roughly the road industry is far stronger than it is in the broadband industry. The industry exhibits natural monopoly characteristics. Most roads are actually built by the state. And there are obvious negative externalities associated with the use of roads in terms of both traffic and pollution. Yet regulators in this industry, at least in Virginia, are experimenting with new approaches that allow some customers to pay for a priority to see if consumers as a whole can be made better off. In the broadband industry, the FCC, by contrast, is seeking to categorically prohibit paid prioritization. When the FCC regulates the broadband industry more tightly than Virginia regulates its highways, in my view, there's something pretty clearly amiss with the regulatory process. And in the spirit of today's program, one might even call the FCC's approach over the top. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take any questions. Fire away.
So this might be the first time that I know of where one agency by unilateral fiat has basically taken another agency's jurisdiction. I mean, you're both independent agencies. Your powers are out of Congress, not the executive.
I'm going to avoid saying I am an independent agency. Let me let you finish the question.
My question is, what does happen tomorrow? And obviously, that means, well, I assume somebody will appeal it. But what do you mean?
This is my first rodeo on this too. I mean, I think it's unclear. There are some, I think, within the walls of the FTC that are hopeful, and we'll get the common carrier exemption lifted through Congress. That's something the FTC has asked for a really long time. I wouldn't recommend anyone inside the building holding their breath and waiting for it now. I mean, I suspect we'll know in more detail tomorrow, but I suspect pretty clearly that consumer protection authority inside the building is gone starting tomorrow. I don't think any amount of forbearance would preclude that. I don't think that there's anything that could possibly appear in the proposal that as a legal matter would make that go away. How that works out inside the building, I think, is unclear. And what it does to settlements we entered earlier this year, I suspect, but don't know. And certainly, let me do the talking for myself again disclaimer. I suspect there'll be litigation over those too. So I think it's up in the air. I don't know.
Not from the agency, right?
Right, right. From there'll be challenges to those too. I mean, I think that, you know, there'll be a lot of litigation over that as well, although it'll be sort of battles looking backward instead of forward. We'll see. I don't know. I've done some homework on this, sort of looked for other examples of, I think the way you put it is fair, one agency sort of taking another agency's jurisdiction, at least with respect to specific industries. I haven't found any in modern times.
And do you think it would require a judicial stay on the SEC, the application of the SEC's rules for your jurisdiction to continue during the pendency of any lawsuits?
I think the answer to that is yes, but until I see what, tomorrow, I'll have a better idea.
Yes, Sharon Bogad, Voice of the Moderate. Quick question. If you were to explain this to your grandmother or to an 8-year-old in one quick sentence, how is it going to affect them and thank you, sir?
So I happen to have one of those, but not both. My grandmother passed, but I've got an 8-year-old. I think what I would tell my 8-year-old about what happens to him if it passes. I don't let him use my eye. I think, how I explain this to the impact on my 8-year-old is that a couple of things. One, it is likely that the prices his father pays for the things he gets to do on his mini iPad go up, and that induces his father to allow him to do less of it. That would be the first thing I would say to him. The second thing I would say is that his father believes that one of the important consequences of Title II will be that he will be able to do less interesting things, and he will be able to do them more slowly. He would then storm off and get upset. We're working on that. Yeah?
Back to the first question. Is there a reason for FCC to believe that TC in the past has failed either on the consumer protection side or the antitrust enforcement side? Perhaps with Google, dropping Google, or not pursuing the level of belief that TC is pursuing against Google on search?
I've never heard... I've never heard anyone complain of the FCC, of the FTC, being not sufficiently active in consumer protection. I have heard complaints to the contrary. I've made some of those complaints to the contrary. But I think as a general matter on the consumer protection side, I doubt that there is any coherent view for that, sort of coherent basis for that sort of argument.
The FCC has never criticized FTC publicly or non-publicly for being too lax, too lenient.
Not that I know of. From what I understand and what I'm occasionally told from time to time, one agency criticizing another is relatively rare and frowned upon.
This is getting obviously a lot of public and media attention because of the nature of what's being regulated. This is also then educating people that aren't usually inside the Beltway about things like, oh, he gets to make the rules and not tell anybody, including Congress. How do you think that will impact, if at all, any images of agencies and their behavior in rulemaking?
Let me ask you to ask it again so I make sure I understand, because I don't know what that was in that sentence. Is the question how the public being exposed, sort of how the rules are made, will impact their perception of agencies?
I guess it's just sort of asking your opinion out of fact about. I find most people outside of D.C. that have no experience with are shocked that this man can keep what's contained in this from Congress. I think people that are inside tend to go, yeah. And there's a whole dichotomy because people are more sort of simplistic, like Congress makes the laws and rules, and they don't know about the support of the government, and they don't pay attention to it that much because until now it's affecting their smartphone.
I think a generally fair, totally empirically unproven but I'm pretty sure in my gut correct theorem about perception of Washington, D.C. is that the more one knows, the more cynical one becomes about the way that things work. You know, I'm pretty sure that general theorem applies here. It certainly, I think, when you have people inside the Beltway being at least slowed down for a day or two at the notion that this could happen, I'm sure the outside perception is probably stronger than that. Although, you know, I have to ask my brother's 8-year-old in California to see what he thinks. But I think in all fronts, I just sort of turn that the other direction for a moment. I mean, you know, I work at one of these agencies, and to turn that problem on its head, I mean, the FTC, go on our website to the public comments page, and for decades upon decades upon decades, industry across industry, we comment on proposals from other agencies or proposed legislation in states to regulate various industries all the time. We're very active in the electricity industry in states, for example. You can read across those comments, and we are fairly aggressive in asserting our expertise, especially when asked, you know, how do you think this will work out for consumers? But sort of taking, sharing our view that prescriptive regulation of the sort that you're going to see with Title II is bad. Just historically, agency under Democrats, under Republicans, 5-0 vote after 5-0 vote. Largely staff-driven comments from our Economics Bureau and our policy shops. This is bad. In whatever industry you are thinking about doing this in, you should think about not doing it. All sorts of industries, 30 years straight. I have criticized just sort of, you know, all agencies can get it equally. Not just the FCC, but my own agency. We've been incredibly silent as an agency. No public comments, no public statements saying, as a matter of competition, not just as a matter of losing our jurisdiction, which all agencies don't like, okay? Not just as a matter of losing jurisdiction, but as a matter of consumer welfare calculus, this is bad. It is not just, and in that sense I'm saying it's, you know, so it's, sure, it's my view. But it has been the agency view for this type of regulation across a broad set of industries on a bipartisan basis for a really long time. And I sort of find it not equally disturbing, but also disturbing that the sort of political calculus around this debate, you know, has influenced more than one agency's behavior, in my view. Silence was going to mean I won, but no, go ahead.
Well, Commissioner Wright, assuming 120% what you say about the FTC, just leave antitrust alone and the FTC takes over, do you think that, and I understand that, you know, the APA is interpreted by the Supreme Court, that's, you know, the floor, that's all the due process one gets, but would it be useful to put any enforcement effort in Article 3 courts as opposed to within the administrative and judicial court structure?
It's a great question. I mean, in antitrust, this is generally what we do. We sometimes go through Article 3, but we generally, especially in conduct cases of this sort, you know, we have here, we do sometimes go through administrative adjudication. There's some recent cases where we've done that. We go to federal court, too. You know, I think it would be, there are reasons to do both of those things at different times in conduct cases, some strategic and some having to do with more substantive concerns about whether we need monetary remedies, which we can't get through the Part 3 process. So depending on the type of conduct at issue, I think they're both strategic and substantive things to think about. But we do have those avenues, available now. And DOJ, who, for, you know, frankly, you know, on the sort of existing clearance, it would be DOJ bringing most of the antitrust cases, except and to the extent that you think that the antitrust case implicated content that fell within our, you know, advertising and some other content would sort of more clearly fall on our side of the fence. DOJ is always going to federal court. They don't have the option of going through Part 3. So I think most of this game on the antitrust side would be played in federal court. It was on the consumer protection side, you'd see a lot more administrative adjudication. I don't know if that answered, but I think it describes. Yeah.
You know, under the current regime, the law as it exists before tomorrow, there are at least a few situations I'm aware of where both the FTC and the FCC have taken enforcement actions involving the same subject matter. For example, data throttling.
Sure.
How do you reconcile that?
So, how do I reconcile both agencies doing it?
Yeah.
I think the orders say exactly the same thing. I mean, I think that they're overlapped that to the extent you have conflicts in the consents, I think you've got a real problem. The FTC has been in that space for quite a while. The FCC is a newer entrant on the type of cases involving us exercising our deception authority in broadband markets. I mean, we had more high-profile cases as of late, one in court with AT&T, which I won't talk about, and another that settled, that are sort of deception in the throttling context. We have those cases going back a decade, going back 15 years. I think the type of relief we generally get in those cases, we generally get monetary relief and then some order saying, thou shalt not. I don't think what's happening in the FCC orders, they're only a handful, so this could change, and it could be a real problem in terms of conflict. I don't have an answer yet for whether it is. I think the potential conflict in that area is sort of, it exists. I'm agreeing it exists, but I think it's too nascent to understand yet whether there's going to be conflicts in the consents. I don't think so as of yet, because in both of those, at least in the more recent investigations, I think that they have been integrated in a way that sort of explicitly designed to prevent that. That is, the agencies were working together on those things. What it adds to the world to have them both doing it at the same time, I think is, your guess is as good as mine. Especially if the order is sort of exactly the same, but I'm not sure it's doing much harm either as of yet.
So with that, I give you a hug.
Yeah.
We got the panel.
All right, done deal.
Round of applause for this.